It is Tuesday, January 3rd. You're listening to The Christian Commute, and you're riding home with me, your host, Seth Dunn. I have a full show for you today. And I have one more question in the inbox after today's show. So somebody, send one in. We are still in Ephesians chapter 4. Ooh. Oh, you know what? That's what happens. I got started on the show so fast there. Everything was going quickly. And then my show notes fell. Let me fix them back to the steering wheel. As I said before, we're continuing in Ephesians chapter 4. Today, our show topic is called Climbing the Ladder. You know, yesterday we talked about threats from within, the business model. And today we're going to talk about the tendency of professional pastors and even the expectation and culture of pulpit committees and how they think about climbing the ladder in church world. And before we get to that, we'll do the inbox submission. If you have a question about theology or apologetics, or if you have a show topic suggestion, you can send it in to sethdunn88@gmail.com. Today's question comes from Aaron in Texas, long-time listener. Hadn't written in as much as she used to, but glad to see Aaron's writing back. And we'll get to that after we do Ephesians chapter 4, verses 9 through 10 in the Bible chapter review. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 9 through 10 in the Bible chapter review. And we talked about a psalm yesterday about Jesus descending and setting the captives free. Or I really should say, a figure in the Old Testament who is messianic, who we now know to be Jesus. And Paul is going to add a little more color to his statement. So he's quoted the psalm, and now he's going to talk about why he quoted it. So we're talking about ascending and descending. But before we do, I've got to make a correction. Time to time, I start listening to the program, and I'm like, oh, I need to correct that. I said that wrong. I said predecessors in yesterday's show when I meant successors, talking about Jews. I was talking about Jews, and I couldn't remember the antonym for ancestors or the antonym for predecessors, and I thought predecessors, that's the word I'm looking for. No, it was successors. So descendants and successors. So today's modern Jewish Jews, and what I mean by Jewish Jews, I mean Jews who practice Old Testament style Judaism, are the ancestors, probably more of an accurate description than successors. They're the ancestors of the Jews who rejected Jesus in Jesus' day and Paul's day and did not become Christians. All right, so now I've cleared up that error. Sorry for my word mix-up. Now let's talk about ascending and descending. Hey, these are opposites. Maybe I'll get them right today. All right. So Paul makes the point and is like, how did he ascend if he didn't first descend? So Christ first descended from heaven to earth and eventually Sheol, because he died, and then resurrected. But he first descended, the implication being he descended from heaven in his pre-existence. Christ first descended from heaven to earth. I think Paul says the lower parts of the earth. And I don't know if he means, if he's trying to emphasize the lowness of earth as compared to heaven, or if he's referring to Sheol as the lower parts of the earth. I could have looked it up in a commentary or Googled it, but I was ready to leave work. So you can look at that yourself. I don't think the application is that much different because he's coming from heaven. This is why we call this the Bible chapter review, not a Bible study. So Christ first descended from heaven to the lower parts of the earth, And in doing so, he's setting the captives free. And then, as Paul goes on to explain, he ascended to heaven to fill all things. By filling all things, I think Paul here means to work out God's plan. So Christ being the first fruits of the resurrection, he had to be resurrected and then ascend to heaven. Oh my gosh, a truck is trying to get over and I'm in the lane. It was almost a disaster. I'm in the third lane. I'm one of those people, you know, who passes in the far right lane when people are going too slow in the fast lane. And every once in a while it backfires on you. So Paul is saying here that after Jesus descended, he ascended after he'd filled his purpose. And there he goes to the right hand of the Father in his ascension. So what Paul is doing here is he's identifying Psalm 68 as a messianic psalm. Because Paul, before he quoted the psalm, he talks about having a measure of grace, the gift according to the measure of Christ. Then he quotes Psalm 68, and then he goes on to explain. He goes, what does it mean unless he first descended, then he ascended? So what he's doing here is saying, hey, this psalm here, it's talking about what Jesus did. This is about Jesus. And now he's going to go on and talk about the gifts that Jesus has given the church. And we'll cover those, Lord willing, in the next Bible chapter review. So today was kind of a short review. I'm not even to Adairsville yet. Aaron from Texas writes in. And this, she suggests this as a show topic. And I'm actually pretty sure, it's probably in the archives by now, that I've already touched on these marriage ministries. But Aaron is asking me about marriage ministries in general, and specifically this Re-Engage marriage ministry. That's the brand of it at Watermark Church in Texas, which appears to be some evangelical multi-campus mega church in Texas. Now, I don't know if it's a mega church, but it is multi-campus and it is branded. It's Watermark Church. Now, I don't know if this is a new church or if it used to be So-and-So Baptist Church, but this church is now Watermark Church. All right, how about that brand? And that brand has three campuses. And one of the products and services this business, I mean church, one of the ministries this church, I mean products and services this business, I mean ministries this church offers is this marriage ministry called Watermark. Now, Aaron, you've been listening, I think, for about a year. But the show, I went back and actually listened in the archives today to the original pilot episode. And I think the first episode of the Christian Commute ever was September 15th of, I want to say, 2015. So I've been at this for over 2 years now. And I think there are 300 and I want to say 385 shows in the archive. And I haven't been having to put shows in the archive lately because I bought more web space on Podomatic in my monthly plan. There was a big sale. So I got I was a pro broadcaster. Now I'm like an enhanced broadcaster plus or something. I don't know. But I have 2 gigabytes of space, so I haven't been paying much attention to the archives. But Aaron, if you go to the archives and search around, there's something already in there about these marriage ministries. But since you wrote in, I'll touch on it again shortly. So Aaron mentions in her submission that she has some family members who are involved in this Re-Engage marriage ministry. And she says some of the people that go to it at this church are Christians and some aren't Christians. And she didn't really have any specific questions about it. She just wanted me to kind of address and talk about it. I don't see a lot of benefit that non-Christians can get from Christian ministry outside of evangelism. Because Christianity, the real benefit is spiritual and the changing of your inner man. Now, you can follow Christian norms and mores and probably live an economically better life, but it doesn't change the person and the man you are, or the woman you are, as it may be. Because, I mean, there are Roman Catholics who have some biblical values, and they're lost because they're Roman Catholic. But they still live out good marriages, and they understand that the man is in charge and the woman's to be submissive, and they understand that family is important, and that God comes before family, but then family comes before work. And they have the right mindset of what marriage should be and what kind of partnership it is. So you can try to follow the principles, but Christianity isn't about living better by principles. It's about living in the spirit, all right? The inner man changes before the outer man. So maybe there's some kind of evangelistic outreach, Aaron, that these people at Watermark do. But what I see, when I go to the website, now I don't want to pretend to be an expert on marriage ministry, an expert on marriage counseling, or even an expert on this Re-Engage program. But basically what it is, it looks like a way to get couples into the church. Now, when you're a branded church, a couple is a giving unit. So everybody's marriage could be better. Listen, nobody out there is thinking my marriage is perfect or my relationship with my wife is perfect. Because somebody, whether it be in the last week or the last month or the last year, you fought about something or had some disagreement and you want to enjoy each other more. And that's good. So basically what they're saying is, like, you know your marriage could be better on a scale of 0 to 10. Come on in. This is for everybody. However long you've been married. And what they do is they get people engaged with the church. They give them child care. So while you're in the marriage ministry, now you're in a group. And now you're friends with these people and you want to come to church with these people and make this your church home. All right. Well, wait a minute. I thought it was about making people's marriages better. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Do you see in Scripture a lot of practical, everyday marriage advice like you might get from a marriage counselor? I mean, you have Paul saying, husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church and give yourself up for her. Wives, submit to your husband as unto the Lord, and parents, don't cause your children to be frustrated. I mean, to put it in a nutshell, I can't remember if that's Galatians 5 or Ephesians 5. So Paul does talk about how the family's to be ordered, but he doesn't have any specific advice. Like, listen, when you get home, talk to your wife for 15 minutes a day before you do anything else. Find out about her day. Now, that may fall under the principle of giving yourself up for your wife because, you know, she's been at home with the kids all day, you've been out working, you get home, you want to decompress, but hey, your wife's been the only adult in the house. She wants to tell you about her day. Forget about what you want to do for a while and pay some attention to her. So that's a practical thing, but the Bible really doesn't teach about that practical thing. It gives you the principle. So there are various ways to get from the principle to the practical. And I guess that's what these marriages counseling things or marriage ministries try to do. But I want to ask you, if you just think about this, where were these things 1,000 years ago? 1,000, because remember the church is old. All right, 2,000 years ago. Did you see them 50 years ago, 75 years ago? No? I mean, ask your old parents, you know, if your parents are in their 80s, did you guys do this type of stuff at church? They'll probably say no. Now, granted, society's needs of ministry have changed because divorce is so prevalent, and it's more prevalent than it should be in the church. I think the divorce rate in the evangelical church, I want to say something like 26%. Don't quote me on that, but that's close. It should be zero. So churches now, more so than they used to, have to go out of their way to keep their giving units together. Because here's what happens. When a couple has a divorce, and again, this is an old statistic, the woman's standard of living goes down 40% on average. So here you had a giving unit, and they were making $100,000, let's say. Let's just say the husband made $100,000 a year, they had three kids, and they live in a house, and they get by, and they're giving to the church. Well, now they've gotten divorced. Now they have to have two houses. Their expenses are greater. Now the woman's living off alimony, and maybe the husband is going over here. He's dating somebody else or trying to marry somebody else, so he wants to spend money on this woman. Who gets left out? Nicole, the church. Now they don't have this giving unit thriving and giving money to the church. So it's in the church's best interest, not just for ministry's sake, to look after people, but it's in the church's best interest financially to keep the giving units together. And by offering this marriage ministry, they can get young people in, especially young people who are just married, teach them how to be a family the church way, and hopefully they'll stop coming to the church. So, I mean, I really see these things as kind of like, hey, come hear about our timeshare, we'll give you a free digital camera. They don't want you to be able to take better pictures, they want you to hear their presentation and buy their timeshare. So, that's the way I think a lot of these marriage ministries, I hate to say that any ministry goes outside of the scope of the church, but what do lost people, it's like being seeker sensitive on Sunday morning. What do lost people want to come in and worship God for? Well, what do lost people want to come in and learn how to have a biblical marriage for? Yeah, you're going to have to water it down for them, unless you're going to be salacious and read Song of Solomon to them and be like, yeah, it's talking about sex. He's tasted his wife's garden. It's right here in the Bible. So you want to teach Song of Solomon to mature Christians, not people, oh, no. Oh, Christian commute just got run. I'm stuck in traffic. I'm going to pause the show and ask my computer traffic lady if there's a way around it. All right, I'm back. I'm pretty much stuck. There's apparently a wreck or something in front of me, and there's no exit to go around it between here and there. So, as you longtime listeners know, that when my speed slows down, it somehow affects my ability to think off the top of my head. I guess when I'm driving fast, I'm thinking fast, and when I'm driving slow, I'm out of sorts. So now I'm out of sorts. Oh, but I was to the end of whatever I had to say about the Bible, or the, see, I'm gone. I was at the end of whatever I had to say about Aaron's question in the inbox. By the way, SethDunn88@gmail.com. Don't forget to send in your submissions to the inbox. And I'm not condemning all these marriage ministry programs, but quite frankly, I've never thought much of the special marriage events that I've attended. I had a newlywed Sunday school class once. Went over Song of Solomon, of all things. And I thought it was pretty good. Not that Solomon is the greatest husband in the whole world. Because, you know, you got Song of Solomon, and it's supposed to be about Solomon and the Shulamite woman, and this is his true love, and they find one another, and they get married, and you think, oh, how romantic. And then you're like, you read the rest of Solomon's life. It's like, oh, he had 800 wives and concubines. Okay. What a great guy. So there's that. So Aaron, thank you for writing in about that. Y'all be wary about marriage ministries. Here's the thing about making your marriage work. If you're grounded and rooted in Scripture, and if you think it is immoral to look after myself before I look after my wife, or it is immoral to disobey my husband and buck against my husband, or it is immoral to separate from my wife in a divorce, and it's really even immoral to entertain the idea of maybe should I get divorced. Listen, if you're weighing the pros and cons of would divorce be good or bad for my life, you've already sinned. You're doing it wrong. What's Jesus say? The Lord Jesus said, what God has put together, let no man separate. So don't separate from your wife. So if you're going to these marriage counselings or marriage ministries to prevent divorce, you've already lost. If you're going to them to think, hey, maybe there's some good practical tips so how we can have a better marriage, well, then that's I think that's a good idea. But husbands, listen. Don't lead your wife into some program at some multi-campus megachurch. They're just trying to get you plugged into their system, man. It's just a brand. And you're a mark for them. They want your money. especially if you're already going to another church. All right. Now, let's go to today's show topic suggestion, which kind of fits in with what I was just criticizing about multi-campus churches. Climbing the ladder. Now, you remember yesterday, is that a bus that's tipped over? Oh, this is a disaster of a wreck. Hold on. There is a huge vehicle tipped over on its side up here. If you will recall from yesterday, we continued in the Threats from Within series. And we talked about the business model way of doing churches, running church like a business. And in keeping with the Threats from Within series, now I'm going to talk about kind of an example and what tends to happen. You know, we've got the abstract threat, and then we've got what's really happening. Today's show is probably still going to be a little more abstract, but let's talk about climbing the ladder. In the corporate world, people want to climb the ladder, so to speak. They come in as an entry-level person, and if they work hard, they can get promoted to a supervisor, and then middle management, and then senior management, and maybe even the COO or CFO or CEO or president or something like that. So people climb the corporate ladder, and as they develop in one company and develop their careers, they might be blocked in their current job. You know, they have the ability to move up, do more, and earn more, but there's no openings in their company. So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to apply for a job at another company to do something similar. So they're trying to climb the corporate ladder, not their company's ladder. You understand the difference of what I'm saying? I had a friend in high school. His name was Brandon Dial. His dad's name was Phil. Phil was some muckety-muck boss man at Shaw, which, if you're from Cartersville, it's big, you know, that's a good company to work for, Shaw Carpets. You know, here around Dalton, Calhoun, and Cartersville, Shaw is a big-time company, a big employer here. Very respectable to have a job at Shaw. And Phil started out, you know, when Brandon was a baby and Phil was, you know, out of high school, as a janitor at Shaw. But he climbed the corporate ladder all the way till he was a, you know, big-time boss man at Shaw. Good for Phil. But he stayed at Shaw the whole time. Kind of the same story as my dad. My dad got out of college. He went to work for Quaker doing production planning. And then he retired from Quaker as, you know, some kind of logistics muckety-muck. My dad decided who got Gatorade or something like that. Anyway, they stayed in the same company. And that was typical, actually, of previous generations in the workforce. But now people tend, instead of climbing the ladder at their company, like at Shaw and at Quaker, maybe somebody might start out at Shaw and then they jump to Mohawk. And then they're going to jump to engineered floors. And then, well, maybe they're going to get out of the carpet business altogether, and then they jump to Volkswagen or something like that. So they're moving up, but they're going to a different company, and you know they're not really showing any kind of loyalty or dedication to a company because really they're just an employee, a hireling, so to speak. And nothing inherently wrong with that. That's just how people climb the corporate ladder. As they get more educated and they get more experience on their resume and they've proven they can do stuff, they want somebody to pay them more, even if it's a different company, for doing what they can do. All right, so that's that. Now here's where this creeps into church world. When you turn your church model, not just your church but the entire evangelical culture, into a business growth model, what you're going to attract for the paid positions in those churches are ladder climbers. So I can remember very distinctly when I was in seminary, I think it was in my church leadership and administration class. It's like all my bad examples of church stuff and church leadership, all the bad examples come from my pastoral ministry class and my church leadership and administration class. We were reading a book called Catastrophic Crisis by Dr. Steve Lemke. And Steve Lemke is currently the president of Bruton Parker College in Georgia. He was the president of Tennessee Temple University before it went out of business, and before that he was the dean of the North Georgia campus of the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, the greatest seminary on planet Earth. He's graduated such illustrious theologians as me. All right? And unfortunately, Russell Moore. So, I'm getting out of traffic. Hold on. I'm being freed from the traffic. Yes. Yes. Come on, get out of my way, tractor trailer. So I was reading this book, and it was about ministers who and pastors or seminary presidents or whoever who had faced a crisis in leadership and how they handled it. And it was to prepare us seminary students. One day, you're going to be the pastor of a church, and something bad's going to happen. How are you going to handle it? So it was a pretty decent book, but I remember there was a vignette. It wasn't assigned to us, but it was a vignette about Frank Cox. Now, he is the pastor of North Metro Church. It's a mega church in Gwinnett County. It used to be called like Gwinnett Baptist Church or something like that, or Pleasant Hill Baptist Church. I think that was the name of it. But now it is North Metro Church. Branded. No, don't say we're Baptists. And the story starts off about Frank Cox, himself a graduate of the finest seminary in the world. I think he either went to NOBTS. I think he did. Yeah, I wanted to say maybe Southwest, but it's NOBTS. And Frank Cox got a reputation as a church grower, as somebody who could grow a church. Now, this is a pastor. This is a preacher. All right? And so he became a sought-after commodity. So he was serving in a pastorate, I think in Louisiana, and now he got a reputation among whom, I don't know, as a church grower. So all these other churches came a-calling. So what happens to me every once in a while as an accountant? It's like, oh, we need an accountant. Let's go after this guy. Hey, do you want to come work over here? I know you didn't apply for the job or anything, but we'll give you more money. It's like, well, no, I don't want to. I like my job. So here's Frank Cox. He's not, you know, feeling the call anywhere else, so to speak. But he gets the offer from what? The bigger church. Why? Because Frank Cox is a church grower. That's his reputation. Guy who can grow a church. So if this guy who can grow a church is over here at this Baptist church in Louisiana and he's paying $60,000 a year, we can give him $100,000 a year and he can come do the same thing for us. You know, forget any loyalty to the sheep he's shepherding or the people he's in covenant with. I mean, what would you think about a person who changed churches for no reason other than, you know, they just like the other one better? Yeah, I know I'm in a covenant community with you people. I've joined your church and, you know, everything's fine at this church. I'm going to go over here, you know, because they got a better Disney-fied nursery. Well, that goes with workers, too. So Frank Cox moved. And you can actually find this on Google Books. I've written an article. I think it was called Trusting God and Doubting Frank Cox, where Frank Cox goes on to tell some like really fantastic stories about taking communion with homeless men who were actually angels, not really homeless men, and they had French bread and grape juice. And I'm really thinking, like, if angels came to take communion with me, one, I think they'd recognize, you know, since they're angels and all, that it's a church ordinance, and maybe it's something we don't need to be doing, like, alone in my office. And two, if angels are coming to take communion with me, shouldn't, you know, they're angels. Don't you think would angels would get the elements right, that they would have unleavened bread and not French bread? Now, we know they would not have wine because they didn't drink alcohol in the Bible, right? The wine that Jesus was drinking in communion was not really alcoholic, right? Okay, so seriously, you'd think they would have the proper elements. And I don't care if it's grape juice or wine, but they wouldn't have French bread. So it's just this whole fantastical story about what Frank Cox went through when his wife was facing a tragic terminal illness. But anyway, how did Frank Cox end up there? Because he was brought there as a church growth man. Hey, we'll pay this guy and he'll grow us. And now that's the idea for people who go to seminary. So young men go to seminary and they think, well, I want to be a professional churchman, a professional pastor, and I'm not looking for to serve my church, I'm looking to serve a church, and whichever church is the highest bidder. So there gets to be an entire industry of, like, somebody goes to seminary and they're a good preacher and they find a job at a small church, and the bigger churches look at all the smaller churches and they think, I've identified that guy. So he gets hired by a mid-sized church, and he's doing really great things at this local church, but they don't pay him enough, so he's going to go to the big place. Now he's at the bigger place, and now he's going to do a project and go get his DMIN, Doctorate of Ministry. There's two kinds of doctorates you can get at seminary. One's a PhD, which is an academic degree, like how to be a theologian or a professor at something like Greek. Like, I can get a PhD in apologetics or Greek or Hebrew or systematic theology, things that I can be an expert in theology. And then there's a professional doctorate. Like, this is how I can be a professional pastor, a DMIN. I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I know how to grow churches. And then you really hit the big time. You're Dr. So-and-so, the great preacher who's drawing people from all over town. But what do? You start climbing that corporate ladder, because the church has been set up as a corporation, and you're going to play the game just like any other manager out there in the corporate world, moving from church to church. You're not going to stay more than 5 years until you get to the big mega church that you grow, that you got all this money to pay for. And here's the thing, I've said it again. No pastor that I've ever heard of, if this has ever happened, somebody write me in and tell me about it. Write into me and tell me about it. But this never happens. No pastor ever gets up on Sunday morning after he's been in a church for 4 or 5 years and had success there, the people love him, he's been taking care of them, and he says this: I have received a job offer from a bigger and more prosperous church. They have offered me $20,000 more a year, and they're going to give me my own secretary. Therefore, I resign here. Thanks for the memories. I'm going to move on to this bigger church for more money. No, it always goes like this. Well, you know, I was just sitting at home, minding my own business, preparing a sermon, asking God what I could do for Him. And then I got a call out of nowhere, and somebody had recommended my name to so-and-so big Baptist church. I wasn't looking for a job. I told them I wasn't interested, but they said, just come and visit and preach one sermon in view of a call. And I said, all right, I'll pray about it. And I prayed about it, and, you know, I wasn't sure about it. And my wife said that, you know, I should definitely think about going, that she thought the Lord had placed it on her heart to go. So, you know, we went down there a few weeks ago and I preached the sermon, and God just told me this is the place for me, and God has called me to this bigger church over here. That's what they say, this other church over here. Nobody ever gets up and says, hey, really great church with 1,000 people that pays me $80,000 a year. This is a great church, but it's just too posh here. I've got it too easy. God's called me over here to the wrong side of the tracks to be a bivocational pastor at this little church full of old people who can't pay me much and they're dying off. But I feel really I need to go shepherd these people. God's called me into a much smaller salary and less success. No. Just like I'm not going to go home and tell my wife, hey, I just left my job as controller at the carpet mill because I want to go be a bag boy at Publix, because that'll give me more of an opportunity to converse with strangers on an everyday basis and get to know them and share the gospel with them. God's called me to take a $60,000 pay cut. Oh, not counting benefits and stuff. I mean, I don't know what bag boys make. How would my wife look at me? Yeah, exactly. She would probably get very angry. So the pastors seem to be the only ones who do this when they're doing what? Climbing the corporate ladder. Because if I go home and tell my wife, hey, the carpet mill across town needed a new controller and they like my skills in spreadsheet making, and so they're going to offer me a 20% raise. So they're going to pay me a whole bunch more money. So I went over there and I'm going to take that job. Yay, honey, good for you. I'm so happy for you. You work so hard and we're going to get more money. Hey, I need a new minivan now. That's how that goes. Because what? I'd just be climbing the corporate ladder. Because that's how corporations are set up. And now that's how the church culture is set up. And that's how seminarians are taught to think. You need to climb that corporate ladder. Yeah, start out here as the youth intern. Then you're going to go over here as the, you know, the youth minister. Then you're going to be the associate pastor in charge of youth. Then you're going to be the associate pastor in education. And then you're going to be the senior pastor of this small church. And then once you get your D-men and you've preached and you've shown that you can grow and grow a church and people will come to hear you, and, you know, they don't really care about the Holy Spirit drawing there. They've come to hear your speeches on Sunday. Then you go to the big church and you stop moving your family all around. Guys, it shouldn't be this way. But that's where that threat from within of the business model has taken us, and we have ladder climber pastors. They are climbing the corporate ladder. And I want you to think about this. Let's pretend that you are a large landowner in ancient Israel, and you had various herds and flocks. So many that you could not take care of them all. And you had to hire shepherds to look after your sheep for you. And they didn't own your sheep. So if a wolf or a bear attacked them, since it wasn't their property that they were protecting, they're just like, well, you know, I might lose a few sheep here. I'm not going, you know, my family's not going to go hungry if these sheep, you know, get eaten. I'm not losing my property. I'll just let the bear have it, okay? But that it's called the agency problem. If you study this in management school, it's the agency problem. When you've hired someone to do work for a company, they don't own it. They don't have any skin in the game. So there's a certain risk of them doing what's called shirking, as in they're supposed to be working, but they're not. Or they could be working harder or better, but they don't feel incentivized to, because they don't, you know, they're going to get paid, you know, $100,000 to produce an output of 95%. They could probably put out an output of 97%, but they'll still get $100,000. So why would they do it? That's the agency problem, and that's the risk of shirking. They could probably get away with an output of 93%. They're not going to get fired because they didn't do that bad. They're still going to make $100,000. So why not try 2% less? And this is how management struggles with the agency problem, and that's where they come up with bonus programs and stock incentives, well, stock options and stuff like that, to get people to have skin in the game and to motivate them. So that's how companies deal with the agency problem. So, Matt, now go back to my hypothetical. You're this big landowner in ancient Israel, and one of your best shepherds retires. He's too old to do it anymore, so he retires. He's going to go home and live with his kids and look after his grandkids for the rest of his life. He just can't walk with the sheep anymore. He can't fight the lions and tigers and bears anymore. So now you've lost one of your best and most experienced shepherds. You can't go down to the local shepherd training school, not that one exists, bear with me, and get some fresh out-of-school shepherd who hasn't apprenticed yet and replace this guy's level of output. And he was looking after two or three herds, and he was managing some other shepherds. Now you're in a bind, and you're looking around in your organization, and you don't have anybody who's there yet. You have a few good mid-level shepherds, but they're not ready to take that step up. So what are you going to do? Well, you're going to advertise a job for a shepherd. And it just so happens that you know that one of your rival shepherding companies has a great shepherd. Yeah, he's really good at sheep organizing. He's really good at sheep yield. He has more sheep births than he has sheep losses and deaths from bears and illness. His name is Frank Cox. Franxius Coxius, how about? His name is Franxius Coxius, because he's a Roman. It's ancient times. So you go over to Franxius Coxius, and you say, Franxius, I see you're getting $1 million per year to do this job. I'm going to offer you $1.1 million per year, Franxius, to come work for me. And he goes back to his employer and he says, I've been called. I've been called to go over here and work for 10% more. Thanks for employing me. I'm going over here now. And all the sheep that he had spent his career protecting, well, now they're going to have a less effective shepherd and they might get eaten. But he doesn't care because what was he? He was a hireling. What is he now? He's a hireling. The corporate world is full of hirelings who must be incentivized. Do you know what I am at my job? I am a hireling who must be incentivized. Now, fortunately, I'm a Christian who has a Christian work ethic. I've got that Protestant work ethic. And no matter what I'm doing or what I get paid, I'm going to do it as unto the Lord, because doing a job is just a good job is just a morally right thing to do, right? But I've got a bonus structure. So the better the company does, the better I do to incentivize me to work harder than I could just get away with. And you know what? If some other company comes and offers me more money, I'm not going to say, no thanks. I've been charged with costing this carpet. This is my carpet. I have to cost it. And I have to protect my inventory. This is my inventory. It's mine. I have to protect it. I'm going to say, well, who's my supervisor going to be? Where is it going to be located? What kind of benefits do you have? Are my work hours going to be different? And if everything is right, I'll go. Because it's not my inventory. It's the company's inventory. And I'm just a hireling, like everybody else who works there. And if we create in churches a culture of hirelings, that's what we're going to get. We're going to get people who don't care about right or wrong or what the right thing to do by the Bible is. They're going to care about keeping their job and pumping the church numbers. Church discipline, no, that loses people. What we're going to do is we're going to isolate the people who may be problematic. Like at work, if you've got somebody who's problematic on the floor, you get rid of them and replace them with somebody who won't lower everyone else's productivity. And if that person's right, and everybody's breaking the rules except him, and he's being mistreated, well, you can't really change the culture, so it's going to be more profitable. You can't change the culture all at once. It's going to be more profitable to shoo that guy out the back door, give him a little severance, hire somebody else, and change the culture a little at a time, because that's how pragmatism works. And when you do that in church, you get somebody whose job it is not to shepherd sheep and protect against wolves. You get somebody whose job it is to stop differentiating between sheep and goats, because he gets paid for butts in the pews and money in the coffers. He's a hireling, not a shepherd. They're not his sheep. A good pastor is an under-shepherd of the good shepherd. The hireling runs away. So corporate church culture has brought us hirelings. And you know what it's brought us? It's brought us pulpit committees and churches full of deacons making management decisions and elders making management decisions who are of the mindset that they need to hire a hireling to grow the church and do this, that, or the other. Because they're running the church like what? A business. And if they sat back and thought that ultimately the church is the people, however many God provides for us, and ultimately, we don't really, you know, we don't need a big building. We're not required to have a building at all. It's nice to have a building because you can get a playground if you have a building, right? And, hey, listen, I like having a church building, and I like having a fellowship hall because we can go have a Lottie Moon soup fundraiser and then go outside and play. That's awesome. But if we lost our fellowship hall and we lost our playground and we lost our sanctuary, we would still have a church. But when it becomes about growth, it's about paying the mortgage on the church, saving up money to buy a new church, getting more equipment. We need sound systems. We need money, money, money. Not holy, holy, holy. Money, money, money. Thou cannot serve two masters. Oh, wait a minute. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. Early in the morning, our song will rise to thee. Money, money, money. most important facet. Early in the morning, we'll find out how to get more of thee. Thanks for listening to The Christian Commute. Watch out for the corporate church model. Oh dear. My minivan is in my driveway, dismantled right now. Thank you for listening to The Christian Commute. Oh my gosh, 45-minute show today. It was the traffic. Thanks for listening. Keep the questions coming in. As always, God bless. Lord willing, I'll be back with you tomorrow.